Michelle Mahoney from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division to get things started.
Great. Thank you, Jean. My name is Michelle Mahoney, and I'm with EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and we've been doing these mining webinars for, up to about 8 years now. It's a series, and we recently held a day-long meeting with the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable that focused on mining site characterization and treatment. We had some great presentations and decided that we would do a mini session of three presentations via the CLUIN webinar based on the people that gave presentations. So today is number one. Hopefully you can join us for the other two. If not, as Jean mentioned, they will be archived. So I wanted to just orient you to some of the resources we have related to mining site cleanup. We have a focus area on CLUIN. It's at cluin.org/mining, as you see on this slide. And here we post updates, the meetings that we find. You'll find archives to all of these webinars and a lot of other resources. And one thing we're working on is a treatment technology research project that we're going to pull together all of the information we can find on treatment technologies for mining sites, and we'll have that summarized here on that page. So be sure to check it out. There's a lot of resources available here related to cleanup of mining sites. And I already mentioned today's webinar is part of a series, and we're going to have a couple more presentations coming, but Rosalind will talk a little bit more about that. But at this point, we have Bill Lauder with us from the Department of Interior, and he was one of the chairs of the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable meeting in May on mining treatment and cleanup. And I was going to turn it over now to Bill to give a few opening remarks before we start today's presentation.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to be on this webinar. I work in the Office of Environmental Policy and Compliance with the Department of Interior. I'm also a member of the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable, and they were kind enough to host us this past May to talk about heavy metals associated with mining sites. We have a couple speakers. Doug Cox and Angela Mates will be talking today about one of our sites, Red Devil Mine, which is in Alaska. And I'll let them get into the details about it. But the department manages a broad range of public lands, especially out west in Alaska. And mining's been an important part of the American economy since day one and continues to be. But we have some legacy sites where due to past mining practices, it's left either contamination and or safety issues out there for the public. And thanks to the work of both Doug and Angela, we're working to address many of those sites right now. Heavy metals are kind of the legacy with most of these mining sites, along with acidic mine drainage. Each of these has its own unique issues to be dealt with and addressed, and we're very fortunate that in most of these cases we have great professionals out there working on these. So, with that, I will turn it back. If you have any questions, please ask Doug or Angela about any questions you might have about mining sites. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Bill. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us and helping pull together all these great presentations that we can now archive for the future of people who want to learn about some of these issues. So now I'm going to just turn it over to Rosalind Ramsey, who is also in the Superfund office with me, and she's going to give you an overview of today's webinar and get us started with the speakers.
Thank you, Jean, Michelle, and Bill for all that information, and thank you all for joining us today. As Jean and Michelle have said, I'm Rosalind Ramsey, one of the moderators for today's webinar, and I would like to introduce the talk and the speakers for today. As a reminder, today's webinar is the risk assessment for mercury releases to the Kuskokwim River from the BLM Red Devil Mine site in Alaska. And this talk will be given by Doug Cox, a PhD, a risk assessment specialist from BLM, and Angela Matt, PhD, a contaminant specialist from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Environmental. This presentation will describe the Red Devil Mines Risk Assessment Approach, a multiple lines of evidence approach developed by the Bureau of Land Management to incorporate a number of site-specific risk assessment findings into new site decision-making. Dr. Doug Cox is a toxicologist and environmental risk assessor for the Bureau of Land Management at the National Operations Center in Denver, Colorado. He is currently the Senior Risk Assessment Specialist for BLM, primarily working on abandoned mine lands and hazardous material sites. Dr. Angela Matz is a wildlife toxicologist for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska, an affiliate faculty at the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, University of Alaska Fairbanks. She has studied exposure and effects of a wide range of pollutants, from PCBs to lead shot, on wildlife and fish species and other habitats. Her work emphasizes the pathways and connections among trophic levels and contaminants, with a special focus on mercury and other metals and substance foods. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Doug to start beginning his presentation.
Thank you, Rosalind. Good morning, good afternoon, and greetings to all of you joining me for this webinar. A special thanks to Jean, Rosalind, and Michelle from EPA for setting this up. I'm Doug Cox, the Risk Assessment Specialist at BLM in their National Operations Center in Denver, Colorado. Today's presentation will focus on the releases and possible human health risks from mercury from the former Red Devil mine site in central Alaska. The site has not been operational since the early 70s, when the operators abandoned it and walked away, leaving all the buildings and waste in place. This first slide here, shows the old facility portions of it. There was smelters and slag heaps and production buildings scattered around the area where the pointer was moving. All that was just left there. This is a little creek that runs out from the site into the river. This area was a delta formed from some tailings and waste that were just bulldozed and swept out into the river. Obviously, these were the days before mine sites required substantial bonding and reclamation activities. So on to the next slide. This presentation today is organized in three parts. I'm going to be talking about the site setting and its access to the Kuskokwim River, some of the history of the site, and some of the summary of the relevant site investigations that have been done over the years. Then I'm going to turn it over to Angela to talk about a fascinating fish telemetry and tissue study that's been done in the Kuskokwim River. And then finally, I'm going to try to tie things together with a discussion of the human health risk assessment issues with this multiple lines of evidence approach that we've developed. So for an overview of today's talk and some of the issues, mercury and other chemicals, particularly arsenic and antimony, from the mine site and from other regional mineralized zones in the area have been detected and are known to be present both in the river sediment and in various biota, fish, plants, benthic invertebrates that are in the local area. So as we'll see in a couple more slides, Red Devil Mine is obviously located in a mineralized zone, actually called the Mercury Belt in central Alaska. And so there's regional impacts associated with the river and not just the mine site alone. The real concern and the focus of this talk is the methylation of mercury and food chain biomagnification. The higher you get up in the food chain, the upper trophic levels, such as pike and burbot, that are valued fish species for subsistence, local subsistence people, the biomagnification can have significant effects in terms of the mercury level in the tissues of these particular fish species. And then finally, as I'll go into this further, you'll hear this phrase a few times. I'm going to describe a multiple lines of evidence approach in which I integrate a number of relevant findings into risk management decision making at the end of the process. So here's a map of sort of southeast and central Alaska. The Kuskokwim River, forms this drainage right through here. Not shown on this map, but further over, you know, this area is the Yukon River, which drains a larger area. The Kuskokwim is the ninth largest river in North America by volume, with an average discharge rate of 67,000 cubic feet per second. It's a big body of water. There's multiple large tributaries draining into the Kuskokwim. Here in this particular red triangle, that's where the Red Devil Mine site is located. Just to give you some background and location, you see these other rivers in the local area. There's the Holitna, there's the Aniak, there's the Swift, the Stony. Those are all slightly upstream of the Red Devil, but they're also located in this mineralized area. This is a shot of the Kuskokwim River taken 2 years ago now. You know, it's close to 300 yards across, so it's a good body of water. I live in Colorado, you know, where 10 yards across is a big body of water, so to see something like this is pretty impressive. There's a strong current flowing through it. It's pretty turbid. It carries a lot of suspended sediments. Certainly in the stretch of river near the site where we're sitting and looking out, there's few shoreline wetlands. They're very linear shorelines, you know, heavily scoured along the way. Not a lot of vegetation in this stretch of the river. So it's a big, fast-moving, busy river. And it's an important river, obviously, for transport up and down it during the summer months, you know, for barge transport to get equipment up and down the river, since Central Alaska is not well served by road and rail. Some of the issues related to Red Devil and the Kuskokwim River: numerous mercury deposits across the region. It's in a mineralized zone. As we've already mentioned, fish are an important local source of protein. And, you know, as I'll keep coming back to, mercury's been detected in fish across the region, as well as the Kuskokwim watershed. So it's not strictly a Red Devil area only issue. It's a wider issue. These dots on the map, some of these red triangles, show sampling sites where mercury mines are present up and down various waterways. So, you know, it's a well-mineralized zone with lots of historic activity. A brief history of the mine itself: cinnabar ore was the source of the mercury, and it was mined off and on from 1933 up till 1971, you know, and it varied depending on the market price. It would be open for 3, 4, 5, 10 years at a time, and then the market prices would change. Other sources might come online, or the demand would slump. And Red Devil, being in a fairly remote, expensive to get to, and difficult place, you know, that was really affected by the market price, and they would shut down for a period of time until 1971, when they shut down completely. And it was responsible for nearly all of the historic mercury production from Alaska, some 1,300 tons. Most of the mining was done underground, so we don't have big open pits. It was done underground in tunnels and borings chasing seams, although there was some open mining near the end. And it was sort of a do-everything kind of site. They did mining, milling, retorting, chemical storage, waste disposal, all of it done on site. So they barged the equipment in, and they barged the flasks of mercury out, and everything else, the buildings and the waste, were just left on site until they finally walked away from it all. At some point not too long ago, in the last 5 years, BLM has disposed of, you know, taken some of the tailings and retort waste and put them in some monofills to try to limit their exposure to the environment, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But historically, as you saw in that first slide, a lot of this waste was just pushed into Red Devil Creek and eventually out to the Kuskokwim River. This is just an old picture showing some of the infrastructure that was present at the mine at the time. The Kuskokwim River is over here on the right. This area here is what's known as the Red Devil Creek Delta. And they push sediments down from this main processing area. You can see the blue line, that's the creek running through. So they push the sediments down out into the river to get them off the site. I don't have a scale for that map, but it's not a particularly large site. You can see in the picture on the left some of the big tailings piles that were left. The creek, it's a very modest creek compared to the size of the river, yet they still managed to put quite the volume of tailings down the creek and out into the river over time. This is at a low flow season, you know, where it's just a couple CFS trickling out of Red Devil Creek into this much larger Kuskokwim River. Currently, the site's abandoned. BLM is responsible for conducting investigation and cleanup activities. There is no PRP for the site. We demolished the buildings, removed fuel tanks and buried materials in the early 2000s. So there's been interim actions taken to just try to stabilize the facility and reduce the amount of material flowing off-site. Red Devil Village is a small population located nearby, but there are no other industrial facilities in the area. We started a remedial investigation and feasibility study, an RIFS, in 2009. The RI was completed in 2014, but it really focused much more on the groundwater and the upland setting where the site physically was located and didn't fully address the river. Currently, we're doing a supplemental remediation investigation where we collected additional data. As part of that will be the supplemental human health and ecological risk assessment that's in development that will be discussed further by me in the second half of this presentation. And I would note that the ecological risk is not a topic of today's presentation. Please don't think it's been forgotten or neglected. It's just a side issue that, you know, is bigger than we could fit into the discussion today. So this is just a couple pictures of the site then and now. In the 1960s, when they were still doing operations, you can see them, the waste and the infrastructure located along the mine site. Right now, much of it's been stabilized. This is not water. This is a big plastic tarp that's covering a lot of the tailings and a stabilized a pile up out of the creek, waiting for final decision and disposal. So at this point, that really covers the introductory history that I wish to give to this discussion. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Matz now to talk about a really interesting evaluation of fish in the local river, because the fish tissue and methylmercury risk were a big part of the motivation for this study. So I'll be back and talk more later on the risk assessment, but for now, it's Angela's turn.
And Doug, actually, before we let Angela jump in there, I'm going to pull the audience a bit to get a little bit more background information about some of their experiences. So for the live attendees who are joining us through Adobe Connect, we have three questions that should now have appeared in the middle portion of your screen. The first question asks, have you been involved in environmental restoration projects that involved? And there are three options. You can check all that apply, whether they were large waterways, contaminated sediments, or edible fish. So check them off as you go along. If you haven't done any of those, then you can simply leave them blank. The middle question asks, do you have experience in investigating abandoned mine sites? And we can simply answer yes, no, or not applicable. The type of work you do doesn't actually involve that level of work. And then the third question, have you developed a site-specific, quote, multiple lines of evidence strategy for any projects? Again, yes, no, or does not apply. A number of you have already started casting your votes. You guys can see those results coming in real time, and this will help our presenters sort of gauge their talks. So just to kind of briefly summarize the trends that I'm seeing for Doug and Angela, it looks like 93% of you have worked with a contaminated sediment site, so a large percentage of you have experience there. And almost 60% of you have also worked with large waterways, which shouldn't be surprising if they were contaminated sediment sites, and then also edible fish. So we do have some significant experience in these types of projects. It looks like about 60% of you also have worked on abandoned mine sites, but 35% of you have not, so this could be some new areas for you. And then in terms of that multiple lines of evidence strategy, again, about 65% of the audience has worked on projects like that or have used that approach, but about 30% of you have not. So it looks like we have a nice mixture of skills and experience levels here. And I think we'll go ahead and, as Doug was just kindly doing, get ready to segue over to our very next presenter. And so, Angela, is whenever you're ready.
All right. Mine is just loading here. Can everybody hear me? Jean, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay. I want to thank Jean and Rosalind and Michelle for all the work they do on this webinar series, and in particular for having us today. I also want to thank my co-authors, Matthew Varner from the Bureau of Land Management, and Matt Albert and Klaus Wittig from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the state of Alaska. The part of this this section I'll be talking about is a collaborative effort between our agencies, but also it's a really good team to work with. I'm a toxicologist, and those guys are fisheries biologists, so we join forces, both agency and as individuals, to get this information collected. As Doug showed you before, and in particular, I'd like you to note the scale here. And I'm not seeing the green arrow. Sorry, Jean. There we go. In particular, note the scale of the Kuskokwim drainage. It's a large drainage, as Doug said, in southwest Alaska, with a lot of cinnabar locations and a lot of mines that were developed off of that. The orange shading that you see is the Kuskokwim drainage. The kind of tan shading that you see is the Yukon drainage above it. It's in a mineralized area that not only has been mined for mercury through the cinnabar, but for other, there's other ores and other mines as well, primarily for gold. So when we're talking about the potential mercury sources that can get into fish, into biota and the Kuskokwim River, because it's so large, it's not just going to be specific sites. There are additional, we have to look at a wide range, a wide scale of sources, starting with the erosion of the underlying mineralized geology. As Doug said, the river is full of silt, full of sediment, and there's constant erosion going on. There's also land use, and here the land use that we're talking about is primarily mining. Mining can accelerate erosion, and it can also increase the bioavailability of metals via acid mine drainage, although that's not such an issue in the Kuskokwim as it is in other places. There's also permafrost degradation, which is occurring in this region with climate change. And permafrost degradation has the potential to release mercury or methylmercury from previously frozen soils and sediments, and it can contribute to changes in carbon cycling, which, of course, is has the potential to affect methylation rates of mercury. There is atmospheric deposition of mercury that happens on a global scale. Southwest Alaska is downwind of industrial activity, including coal-burning power plants in Southeast Asia. And there's also regional deposition in from Alaska itself, from the volcanoes in the Aleutian Chains, which are always going off. We just had another aircraft advisory for a volcano in the Aleutian Chain, and forest fires, and actually I should say wildfires. These are increasing in frequency and intensity associated with climate change. We're seeing some wildfires on tundra that is something that has almost been unheard of in the past. So what determines how the sources of mercury end up in fish and how much ends up in fish? The first is the watershed size and concentrations. A larger watershed collects more atmospheric deposition. If there are point sources, obviously higher concentrations are going to result in higher mercury. Mercury becomes bioavailable and methylated by sulfate-reducing bacteria primarily, which are very happy in wetlands or anaerobic sediments and with a source of organic carbon. Once methylated, it can enter the food chain through algae, microorganisms, invertebrates, and then into small fish. And the primary route of exposure is ingestion through food. Methylmercury does exhibit biomagnification, which we're defining as increasing concentrations with increasing trophic level, and bioaccumulation, which is increasing concentrations over time in an individual. So both trophic level and age of especially the larger fish, which are prized for subsistence use, are important. And the habitats in which the fish live. If they're not in a habitat that exposes them to either a source of mercury or a source of methylated mercury, then their concentrations are going to be less. I'm going to speak a little bit about arsenic, but mostly in contrast to mercury. This is an issue for the human health risk assessment, but not nearly as much as mercury. The arsenic does behave differently in the environment. The primary sources to fish from surface water are erosion, again associated with land uses. And so what is the primary driving factor are the concentrations at those sources that are eroding into surface water. Arsenic becomes bioavailable via bacterial action and or changes in pH. And it's really more of an equal opportunity pollutant for fish. Fish are exposed primarily through water, passing over their gills. It does not biomagnify like methylmercury does. In fact, it's metabolized and can be excreted through methylation. Organic arsenic is relatively non-toxic compared to inorganic arsenic. And inorganic arsenic is typically a very small percentage of total arsenic in fish tissue, although that can vary. So there is bioaccumulation to a certain extent. There is no biomagnification, so we don't really see elevated concentrations up the food chain or up trophic concentrations. What we wanted to do with this work was build on a history of a lot of work on mercury in fish in the Kuskokwim River because it's a mineralized region and because it has heavy subsistence use. Subsistence is defined as making a living from the land or the waters. And Doug mentioned briefly that the fish in the Kuskokwim are a very important source of protein for people in this region. An example that everyone uses is a gallon of milk costs, or half gallon of milk costs, $7 in a grocery store in a remote village, and that's because food that appears in the stores has to be flown in or barged in for the most part. There are few roads, and transportation costs are extremely high. So people do spend a lot of time fishing and hunting, and especially along major rivers, fish are a primary source of protein. Salmon is big, but salmon doesn't fulfill all the needs, particularly in years when salmon runs are low and there are fishing restrictions. So other fish like large northern pike and burbot do help fill that role. We first wanted to build on John Gray's and others' work on the Kuskokwim. They found elevated concentrations of mercury in fish sampled downstream of mined areas. And then the Fish and Wildlife Service and others have contributed to evaluating mercury in a wide range of fish, but particularly northern pike across the Yukon and Kuskokwim deltas. And those had elevated levels of mercury enough so that the state of Alaska has developed fish advisories for mercury. And then finally, building with the work that's going on specifically at Red Devil, to meet the goal of understanding existing levels of mercury and other contaminants in the aquatic community of the Kuskokwim River and select tributaries, and this is to contribute to the assessment at Red Devil, contribute information to the assessment at Red Devil, but also for a more regional look at what levels of mercury were in subsistence fish. Our methods, beginning in 2010, we collected a lot of samples for metals analysis. These included for small fish, whole bodies, small fish and macroinvertebrates, we collected whole bodies. Larger fish, we began by collecting skinless fillets. As we moved into the telemetered portion of the study where we captured fish and put radios in them, we took muscle plugs, which weighed a gram or two, and those were then sampled for metals. The analytical chemistry was done at two labs, Physis Labs in Anaheim, California, and Frontier Labs in Seattle, Washington, according to EPA protocols. We had all data went through an EPA level 4 validation and QAQC review. Methylmercury and inorganic arsenic were done on a small subset of samples, but we used total mercury in further analyses and statistical analyses as a reasonable substitute for methylmercury. As I said, in the latter part of the study, starting in 2011, we captured larger fish. They were implanted with radio tags and tracked. Those motion sensors were indicated mortality, and we determined locations mostly by overflights, and those were monthly overflights, but there were some shore-based tracking stations that we used as well. The data analysis really depended on sample size and distribution and the particular question. We often used linear models, and especially paying attention to using age or length as a covariate for mercury, as that does tend to, as mercury concentrations do tend to be greater in larger individuals. So here is the first map of the project area and sampling locations. The black circle with the star indicates the location of Red Devil Mine. This is kind of zooming in on the maps that you've seen before. Our first effort was sampling small tributaries. These are outlined in red for what we call forage fish, small fish, and macroinvertebrates. We also sampled larger reaches of the larger Kuskokwim River and some tributaries for the larger and generally predatory fish. And just to put this in perspective for you, again, view the scale down here. Don't forget this one, this small headwater creek up here, which is Cinnabar Creek in the headwaters of the Holitna River. That'll be important later. When we expanded sampling locations for putting radio transmitters in the large fish, we moved north and west of the original study area. Here again is Red Devil Mine. We captured fish and implanted them with radios in the up near the headwaters of the Kuskokwim in the Takotna River and outside of McGrath, and then also focused on getting more fish in the George River. So in total, we collected over 900 tissue samples in several hundred kilometers of the Kuskokwim and seven major tributaries. So it was quite an effort. Let's look at the small tributary habitats and biota and and some conclusions that we reached from those. First of all, these are small streams. You saw how little Red Devil Creek was coming out of those, coming out into the Kuskokwim in the pictures that Doug showed you. So the small streams are 1 to few meters across, and they're often less than a few kilometers in length. They do have small fish, which we call forest fish, and these, their movements can be described as local. Everything from sessile organisms to predatory macroinvertebrates that may range less than 1 square meter, slimy sculpins, which may have a home range of 75 meters or so linear distance on the creek. These other fish, the Dolly Varden, Arctic grayling, and salmon, when they are found in these small streams, they're often very young and very small, and they do tend to outgrow that habitat. The conclusion that we found, and I'll show you how we got there, was that there is elevated mercury and arsenic in small creeks with abandoned mines on them, and those are Red Devil Creek and Cinnabar Creek. There is variation, though, and that's largely related to fish age and ecological niche of the macroinvertebrates. Let's get this out of the way. So slimy sculpin and macroinvertebrates were collected in all of the small tributaries that we sampled, but sample size is important in all of those. Nevertheless, what we found was that total mercury in micrograms per gram wet weight, and these are whole bodies because they're small fish, was often significantly greater in Red Devil and Cinnabar Creeks. We're going from downstream to upstream along the Kuskokwim on the x-axis here, but that's only an ordering issue. That's not that's just for purposes of organization. Really, these creeks are pretty separate. They're not related to each other. And it's interesting that this pattern of significant elevation of mercury occurs throughout the different levels of biota that we're talking about. The variation, particularly here in the macroinvertebrates, has to do with ecological niche. The predatory macroinvertebrates had much greater mercury concentrations than did the other macroinvertebrates. We see the same kind of patterns in Dolly Varden and to a certain extent in the juvenile Arctic grayling. Again, we see that Red Devil, which I should point out is represented by two bars here, and Cinnabar Creek, certainly in the juvenile Dolly Varden, had elevated concentrations. Pattern is a little less clear in Arctic grayling. Unfortunately, we did not collect Arctic grayling from Cinnabar Creek, but we still see a general pattern. The variation here in Arctic grayling is associated largely with fish age. We see the same pattern with total arsenic, micrograms per gram wet weight in whole body. Again, significantly elevated concentrations from small forage fish in those two creeks, Red Devil and Cinnabar Creek, which both had abandoned mines on them. So those are the small creeks and the small fish, and now we're going to switch gears to larger fish, larger tributaries, and to mercury. That's the contaminant of concern in the larger fish, which are the ones used for subsistence in the region. So the Kuskokwim River is big. It's very big. It's a huge river, and its large tributaries are actually large rivers in themselves. Probably the biggest difference is that the large river tributaries tend to have vegetated shorelines. They may be braided, and they have a great deal of wetland in their watersheds. And the Kuskokwim tends to be high volume, straight shorelines, non-vegetated shorelines, of course. It all varies, but in large part because the Kuskokwim is so huge, it tends to be a much more scoured type of river. There's relatively larger fish. There we go. Relatively larger fish in these bigger tributaries. Burbot, which is also called lush in the region, northern pike, and then the adult Arctic grayling. They have obviously relatively larger home ranges, but those do vary by species depending on which habitats they use. And the mercury patterns are therefore species specific. The one thing that's important to note about all these rivers is that there are seasonal variations in flow. And most of these freeze solid in the winter with deep overwintering pockets for fish. And that, of course, makes a difference as to where they spend their winters. So for the tagging portion, the fish tagging portion of this project, and that happened in 2011 and 2012, hundreds of fish were tagged. And we're going to focus really on the burbot and pike tags, the burbot and pike because their tags lasted longer and we could get multi-year information on their movements. The tracking data and then combined with individual fish contaminant concentration provided essential information for understanding exposure. I want to say also, though, that catching and tracking these fish really mirrored a lot of the traditional ecological knowledge that exists in the region, and that was transmitted to us by longtime fishermen in the region. So it's not just tracking data, it's TEK plus contaminant levels that contributed to our understanding of these fish and of their exposure to potential mercury sources. So our basic question here is how much time did each fish spend near potential mercury point sources, and therefore how did that relate to their mercury concentrations? Red Devil Mine is the black star in the middle of that. And because we only had monthly flights, our data were not really temporally and not really spatially resolved enough to answer this question specifically. Some fish traveled very long distances between the flights, and we couldn't assign fish location between those flights with any degree of uncertainty. So instead, we compared mercury concentrations in fish among watersheds, and we did this in two ways. First of all, we compared mercury concentrations among fish by their capture watershed, where they were found and where they were captured. And that has a great deal of validity, particularly in setting consumption advisories. But then in terms of evaluating exposure to potential point sources in the region, we compared mercury concentrations in fish among their maximum use watersheds. A watershed in which a fish spent the majority of its time. These watersheds were based on USGS Hydrologic Unit Codes, or HUCs, for Alaska, and that's the picture of them there. Maximum use watersheds, where the fish spent a majority of its time, were then also evaluated for whether we could determine a relationship between concentrations and fish and watershed characteristics that could affect mercury concentrations. We'll get to that a few slides down the road. This is just the first picture. This is an example. These are the data from mercury concentrations in fish in their capture watershed Let me just orient you here. The solid bars are northern pike. The checked bars are burbot. The when it says Cusco here, that it is the main stem Cuscoquim. And sometimes it includes major tributary, such as in the Cusco-Aniak system. Other names here, George, Halitna, and Tacotna, are all major tributaries. This is the picture we need to see when issuing advisories, because where people catch their fish is important. The fishery, the capture locations where we caught them are also fishing locations where people tend to go over and over to catch their pike and their burbot. We can see in general that fish in the mainstem Cuscoquim have significantly lower mercury concentrations than those caught in the large tributaries, but it could also be species related. The burbot have lower concentrations than the pike. In general, pike, when they were caught in the main stem, do tend to have lower concentrations than pike caught in the large tributaries. What's important about those large tributaries, the George, Halitna, and Tacotna, each of them have abandoned lines on them. But that's not the picture we need to see when we're evaluating exposure. We need to understand where those fish spend most of their time. And in order to take a first look at that, we looked at the percentage of telemetered fish that stayed within their capture watershed, where their capture watershed equaled their max use watershed. And those are the solid bars here for northern pike and for burbot, or those that moved, those that traveled, where their capture watershed was not their max use watershed. And those are the open areas here. So for pike, 90% of them stayed put. Their capture watershed was where they spent the most time. For burbot, only 32% of them stayed put. They tended to travel much more. And this is a little misleading. The Cusco-Aniak system here, which is a huge section of the main stem and also a very large tributary. So this is a large watershed in which they stayed put, but I wanted to point that out. Let's take a look at burbot movements. Oh, a couple other things to point out here. First of all, that the Cusco above George is the location of Red Devil Creek. That's the segment, the watershed, in which Red Devil Creek is located. And that pike that were captured here tended not to stay here. And then also the point about that the Cusco-Aniak system there is really large, and even though burbot stayed within it, gives them a lot of room to move. Taking a look at burbot movements, we find that, first of all, their summer locations, and these include many places where they were captured, but also looking at their movements over a couple of years, their summer locations tend to be in the lower part of the Cuscoquim. Some of them we even think were down in the brackish, tidally influenced waters here at the mouth, towards the mouth of the Cuscoquim. In contrast to their winter movements, which are further upstream, and winter also is, we're assuming these are also spawning areas. These fish traveled hundreds of kilometers, sometimes 800 kilometers up and down the Cuscoquim River over the course of a year. So these are traveling fish, and they do tend to spend their time in the Cuscoquim in the large river, and overwinter in areas that either are at the mouths of tributaries or that have deep overwintering holes. If we're trying to determine exposure from point sources, then this is the picture that we need to see. We need to take a look at what watersheds they spent most of their time in. And because they were travelers, they moved quite their max use watershed picture is very different from their capture picture. These are the same fish, just where they were captured versus where they spent most of their time. And even sample sizes are small here, but there was no significant difference among these max use watersheds in burbot mercury concentrations. So we're concluding that they travel, they spend less time near any one potential point source, and particularly those in the large tributaries of the George, Holitna, and Tacotna. If we take a look at pike movements, they're a little bit different. They tend to stay where they were tagged. Here's the George River, and the winter, this is both summer and winter locations of pike, although it's labeled winter. This is where they were caught. This is where they tended to overwinter. They stayed there year-round. And you can further notice in these maps, you know, the mineral locations as well as the green shading here, which is light, but I'm pointing it out. I hope that you can see it. Is the extent of wetlands in these in the George River and I'll show you a couple other tributaries as well. So these not only have these large tributaries, not only have point sources, but they also have a larger extent of wetlands that can serve as methylation engines for mercury getting into fish. Here's the picture for pike tagged in the Holitna and the Hoholitna, further upstream on the Kuskokwim, a major river system. Again, we can see here's Cinnabar Creek over here, the mine in the headwaters of the Holitna system, which in the small fish showed elevated concentrations of mercury and arsenic. And let's also note the much greater extent of wetlands in this drainage system, even compared to the George. So pike were tagged here. They tended to stay here. And again, they have potential point sources and wetland methylation engines in this watershed. There were some pike tagged in the main stem Kuskokwim, and they tended to be moving upstream to spend their winters either in this deep portion of the Kuskokwim right downstream of the Stony River, or they moved up here into the Holitna. So the Kuskokwim is not barren of pike, but they do tend to move out of there for the winter. How do these movements relate to mercury concentrations? Let's put this all up for you. So first of all, again, we're going downstream to upstream, and the similar patterns that we see in terms of where they were captured is also where they spent the most time. They tended not to move out of their capture watersheds, and the mercury patterns are similar. The George, the Holitna, and the Tacotna fish have significantly greater mercury concentrations than do the fish that spent most of their time in the main stem Kuskokwim. There are some small, that Kuskokwim system was a little bit outside of our study area, and so we didn't capture any fish from there, and only a few pike moved down there, two pike moved down there, but that's another large tributary with mines on it. We're going to focus, though, on the George, the Holitna, and the Tacotna because we have more data from there. So because northern pike tend to be, quote, resident in now these large tributaries we've established with the radio telemetry, the differences in their mercury concentrations after we account for their age are therefore more likely to be related to watershed characteristics that could accumulate or biomagnify mercury than is true for burbot. So on this slide, we see the x-axis. These are, again, max use watersheds for northern pike, but they're not from upstream to downstream. Instead, they're in order of mercury concentrations, of average mercury concentrations, which is represented by this blue line. And the blue line is, you know, technically, they're not connected. They should be separate, but it was useful for contrast in preparing these graphs. So we compared these different watershed characteristics, which are relatively gross, but they're potential mercury drivers, with linear models to the mercury concentrations in fish. We looked at total area of the watershed, the proportion of the watershed that was in wetland, and occurrences, mineral occurrences, and mines. And the difference between these two is that occurrences are just noted. There's not a significant amount of ground disturbance, whereas mines could be anything from the massive commercial operations at Red Devil to a gold hole dug in the ground by miners over a couple of winters. So the difference being amount of ground disturbance, and these are determined by the USGS database that they came from, and I'll give you a link to that database. We also separated out whether those occurrences contained mercury or the mines contained mercury, either as a primary or secondary commodity. So relating all these to mercury concentrations in fish, these are the univariate p-values, although we did the modeling in a variety of ways, just showing the relationships between these. And what turns out to be significant, at least in this, is significant, and it kind of matches the graph as well, the occurrences and the mine history of those watersheds. And those were showed significant relationships, not necessarily cause and effect. They're just relationships with the mercury in pike from each of those watersheds, remembering that those watersheds are where the fish spent the most time. I want you to note that we don't have the same significance of relationships when we just separate out the mercury occurrences and the mercury mines. Mercury occurring either as a primary or secondary commodity, we have very low numbers here. And so the modeling was not super robust for this because we were dealing with so few occurrences. Here's a picture of what those occurrences and mines looked like. This is from the USGS ARDF, Alaska Resource Data File database. It can be found here. They've mapped occurrences, open mines, closed mines. This is some of the information that you can get from each of those locations. For example, this is the Granite Creek Mine. It shows you whether it's a mine or occurrence, or even just a prospect, which is a noting of some potential mineral activity, whether that mine is active or not. And many of these small ones, it's not sure, or it could be episodic. And then the primary and secondary commodities. So in conclusion, for this section of the talk, talking about fish movements and their mercury and arsenic concentrations. For the small tributaries, the forage fish and the macroinvertebrates in Red Devil and Cinnabar Creeks, those small creeks, had elevated, measurably and biologically significant elevations of mercury and, to a lesser extent, arsenic. And again, both of these have abandoned mines on them. For the larger fish and the larger tributaries, we found that despite the elevated mercury levels in biota in Red Devil Creek, the turbid and swift conditions of the Kuskokwim River and the unvegetated shorelines in that area really provide limited habitat for pike, and they simply didn't spend much time there. Where they did spend a lot of time was in the George, Helitna, and Tacotna rivers, those large tributaries, but smaller than the Kuskokwim. They had these fish that spent time in these watersheds had the highest concentrations of mercury, while pike captured or that spent time in the Kuskokwim had the lowest. The pike mercury concentrations were significantly related to the number of mineral occurrences in mines, but we didn't find watershed size or percent wetland by watershed to have a relationship with those mercury concentrations. Burbot are a different fish. They traveled widely across the entire study area, sometimes hundreds of kilometers between summer and winter, and overall they had lower and less variable by watershed mercury concentrations compared to the northern pike. All of this information and the more details about our methods can be found in this technical report. It's available online, and that will be available either through the slideshow or Gene. Perhaps you can, I don't know how it will be, if Gene, you can make it available on the screen right now, but certainly this is in the slideshow. You can also just Google BLM Red Devil fish, and you'll find a link to it. Thanks, everybody, and I'm going to turn it over to Doug. Doug is going to talk about how he's going to make the relationship between the scale, looking at the scale of the exposure that we mapped for these fish, relating that to habitat use and their movements, how that relates to the scale of the specific assessment at the Red Devil mine site.
Thank you, Angela. So it's back to Doug Cox again. I'm here to talk more about the risk assessment using a lot of that information that was collected by Angela and her team. This will be the third part of the presentation where I talk about tying together some of the findings from the remedial investigation and the supplemental RI, you know, including that study that Angela just referred to, with, you know, using multiple lines of evidence. And the reason we gave that Angela gave that talk was those, she provided some particularly compelling lines of evidence that we have integrated together with other findings. And so I'm going to try to tie this together and give an overview at the end of this of our preliminary findings from this multiple lines of evidence approach. A couple of quick disclaimers. BLM is the lead agency managing the remedial investigation feasibility program at the site, and we have support from EPA and the state of Alaska, with whom we're working closely on as we develop the reports in this project. So this report summarizes BLM's approach. These lines of evidence represent BLM's viewpoint and not necessarily those of the other agencies. And really, the last bullet here is important. Every effort has been made to develop a multi-endpoint data-driven approach, that more accurately represents site risk than any individual parameter. So I'm going to present these data sets as we go through this approach, or discussion rather. So some of the primary issues and questions associated with this project, you know, is mercury from Red Devil Mine, or RDM, being methylated and getting into the Kuskokwim River food chain? You know, Angela's work clearly demonstrated something, you know, mercury's getting in there, but mercury from the mine, that's really our question, since we're doing a site-specific remedial investigation. To what extent is the mercury site-specific versus regional? Why is mercury the primary concern? Again, as Angela pointed out, you know, the bioaccumulation in the upper trophic level organisms, subsequent human exposure, and the potential toxicity from mercury makes it a really important analyte of concern. The other chemicals, arsenic and antimony, these are the other primary COCs or chemicals of concern. They're toxic, but not as bioaccumulative or biomagnifying as mercury. So we're certainly addressing them in the RIFS. Don't get me wrong, I'm just not talking about them much in this presentation. And then finally, the real endpoint, you know, are local subsistence populations at risk from consumption of Kusko River fish exposed to mercury from Red Devil in particular. So I'm going to skip over some of these slides pretty quickly because you've heard this already. But, you know, Red Devil Mine's located in the Mercury Belt with other naturally occurring sources up and down gradient of our site. Some of the fish consumed by subsistence populations are mobile and move around within the river systems. Yeah, that's important because it confounds, you know, where they get their mercury from. If they just lived at the mouth of Red Devil Creek, you know, we could probably pin it pretty close to Red Devil being the source, like we could with benthic invertebrates or the sculpin with a very small home range. And so, again, our strategy is to develop an approach that incorporates all the relative data so that we can distinguish between the site risk and the regional background risk. The multiple lines of evidence approach, designed to integrate multiple data sets into an evidence-based conclusion, is commonly used in eco-risk assessments, in particular where there are large amounts of data available for multiple endpoints, and it's really important to tie things together that reflect your full understanding of the site. And these are the three primary issues that we hope this lines of evidence approach will help us address, you know, the impact of regional versus site-specific for mercury in the region and the fish and the human use patterns. So the next two slides are tied together. The main bullets here describing the lines of evidence, these are really the four pillars of risk assessment: hazard identification, exposure assessment, toxicity assessment, and risk characterization. I wanted to just put that quick in bullet form before I throw up the next slide. And this is how we've tied it together so that we can integrate and understand how the lines of evidence feed into each other. I'm not going to dwell on them too much right now, except to point out, you know, the four corners are the pillars of risk assessment with different lines of evidence for each of the four stages of risk assessment. I'm going to talk independently about the four steps in risk assessment as we go through it. So you can just see the four colored blocks relate to what we're all oh so familiar with human health risk assessment paradigm. So to start out with, I'd just like to touch on briefly the fact that we've done a remedial investigation that was wrapped up in 2014 and concluded, you know, Red Devil Mine is the source of heavy metals, contaminants are migrating off-site into the river and the creek, and the original remedial investigation looked at ecological and human receptors exposed to the mine, the upland area, but not so much to the Kuskokwim River. So that really left some openings for us to need to investigate in the second phase of the study, the supplemental remedial investigation, which is currently underway and BLM is doing in conjunction with EPA Region 10 and DEC. We're trying to fill some data gaps that we just didn't have. You know, the extent of sediment contamination cross river and down river from the mine site. We did some sediment toxicity tests, really for ecological endpoints, but I'll discuss it briefly in this presentation, and some periphyton tissue samples to look at mercury levels in the very bottom of the food chain. So in addition, you know, the study that Angela described became finalized after the original RI was done, so we're able to have more information from that final report to incorporate into the supplemental remedial investigation and supplemental risk assessment. So in this slide, I'm going to talk a little bit about the lines of evidence as they relate to hazard identification. And pardon me if I go through them kind of quickly here, because I want to get really over more into the exposure assessment. So I'm going to work my way through the hazard ID and toxicity assessment pretty quick, but you can see how the thought process works with the lines of evidence laid out, feeding together, hopefully yielding an informed decision down the road. A lot of this has been said already. I'm not going to dwell on it except to point out that the Kuskokwim River near the site, because of the particular conditions in the river, this big strong river, it represents poor breeding and foraging habitat for pike. Angela's study indicated that we really didn't see much in the way of pike staying near the site, and that's because the conditions and the habitat just aren't right for them. And the site obviously contributed impacts to the river. That's a site characteristic we know. But we've done some early actions, and the input has been greatly reduced. This slide shows some of the mercury sediment sampling locations that have been taken. This is the Red Devil Creek, the old mine site draining out into the river. So these blue ones up here are background samples. The direction of flow is this way, as shown by this arrow over here. And these are just, again, not a comprehensive view. It's just hard to fit it all into the same map. But we've done a number of sampling location and time periods for mercury sampling in the sediments. This just summarizes probably what I just said about the sampling program. So the RI concluded, in the aquatic environment, again, not the upland portion, but in the aquatic environment, there's a measurable and biologically significant elevation in mercury in fish and insects in the creek, but fairly similar levels are found in other watersheds with abandoned mines. And the percent of readily bioavailable mercury is low, which is nice, less than 1% of total, but the historically large amount of mercury released into the site provides ample methylation, even if the rates are low. So again, just these are some of the site characteristics for the hazard identification. Moving on to the toxicity assessment portion of the lines of evidence. This slide, I just felt it was important to highlight some of the toxic effects of methylmercury for humans. You know, most often occurs from eating fish and shellfish. Almost all people have some methylmercury. And the toxicity of mercury is related to neurotoxicity, with particular concerns about children. So, you know, it's a insidious poison that builds up in your system over time. And this is just a summary of the reasons why we are taking it very seriously as we do this study. Now, this sediment toxicity study was really an ecological risk assessment study, but we felt it was informative as a minor line of evidence for the human health toxicity component, the human health toxicity line of evidence, in that there were no effects in 6 of 9 of the study samples of this particular amphipod, you know, where we took sediment out of the river and studied it in the grew organisms in the laboratory for 28 days. In 6 of 9 samples, there were no difference. 3 samples showed a moderate reduction in survival, but in the 60% to 70% range, not down to 10% or anything like that. And there were some confounding variables regarding sediment texture and TOC, total organic carbon, and there were no impacts on growth between the organisms from the sediment upstream background areas or the downstream impacted areas. So, you know, one of the conclusions that were drawn was that Red Devil sediments appear to be minimally toxic to sensitive aquatic organisms. That may not have a direct link to human health, it's indicative, but it does show that the sediments are not themselves particularly toxic to a sensitive organism, which for the, you know, as a line of evidence for the toxicity assessment, we felt it added some weight. Periphyton mercury tissue data, another minor line of evidence. These are essentially the algae and very low food chain organisms that grow on rocks in the river. You can see a picture here. The river is heavily cobbled with big rocks near Red Devil Creek. It's not a nice sediment bottom where things like to grow. We actually had problems collecting benthic invertebrates and small fish from the Kuskokwim River near Red Devil Creek because it's a big, fast-flowing river with large rocks. Methylmercury was not detected in these periphyton samples, the bottom of the food chain, near the mine site, suggesting that mercury released from the mine has not resulted in elevated or detectable levels of methylmercury in this particular component of the food web. So again, not a strong line of evidence, but as part of the toxicity assessment, we felt it was added something to our understanding. This is some a summary of some assumptions from the telemetry and tissue study. Mercury concentrations in Bourbon and Pike were assumed to be 100% methylmercury. That may well be a true assumption. It might be a little bit lower since there was an EPA report cited 80 to 90% may be methylated. We saw higher levels of methylmercury total mercury ratios in the river. Tributary fish were lower. So not a particularly strong line of evidence here, but just something worth noting regarding the methylation rates. Now what I'd really like to focus a little more on is this lower right-hand corner, the lines of evidence for exposure assessment. You can see it's highlighted here with the telemetry data, the fish tissue data, and the local fishing pattern. So I'm going to talk a little about that over the next few minutes. First, I'd like to give some background as to what we're looking for in the risk assessment. I mentioned earlier that we're doing a human health risk assessment as part of the supplemental remedial investigation. You obviously have to identify who you're interested in evaluating the risks for and what their pathways of concern are. So based on what was done in the remedial investigation in the past, we had these three populations: residents, recreational or subsistence users, and industrial mine workers. We're looking at all three populations again, with the recreational or subsistence population being the primary one, adult and children. We'll be doing dermal contact with sediments, incidental ingestion, but for this presentation, the fish ingestion pathway is the most important. I think I just said this first bullet, risk for methylmercury, concerns for local subsistence people. Some of the challenges here that we have for the exposure assessment particularly are distinguishing between the regional mercury impacts versus the site-specific impacts. Angela really got quite a bit of that in her discussion, and I'm going to emphasize some of those key components as part of and how we're going to integrate it into the risk assessment. Evaluating fish movement, where do they get their mercury? They don't live next to Red Devil all the time. And then understanding people's dietary habits and consumption rates. So the Alaska Department of Fish and Game did a survey just a few years ago, and I'll present more of that in the next slide, but they did a survey of the consumption rates and the types of wild food that local people, or these are really site-specific people, local people in the central Kuskokwim area consumed. The primary fish that they ate were salmon, sheefish, Arctic grayling, and other whitefish. That was one class. And then the pike and the burbot, which is a particular interest to this study, the non-whitefish, they were also commonly eaten fish. And, in addition to Angela's telemetry study, traditional knowledge obtained by talking with the local tribespeople that live in the area indicate that they're generally more successful fishing for pike in the tributaries than they are the Kuskokwim River, which seems to be borne out by the telemetry study, which showed that the pike in particular spend their time in the tributaries. And so if you're a fisherman, you're going to go where the fish are and not spend too much time fishing for that particular species, the pike and the Kuskokwim, if you know they're elsewhere. So this was the 2009 study that's been referenced in our risk assessment and other reports. They interviewed 11 of the 13 households in Red Devil area, for a total of 27 residents community-wide. Four species of fish, mostly salmon, made up 67% of the subsistence harvest, which is huge. It just tells you how important fish are as a primary protein source in the local villages out here. And there's a mean value of 26.7 pounds of pike harvested per capita. So it's a lot less than the salmon, but there's still a pretty good amount of pike being taken in on an annual basis. So this just demonstrated, what this helped us understand was what are the people eating and relatively how much are they eating of it. So this shows a local Sleipmute resident. Sleipmute is part of the area. It's not directly adjacent to Red Devil, but just as a frame of reference, this is what they call drift netting, where they anchor something either on shore or to a point somewhere out in the river if they can, and stretch a net across a component of the river and try to catch fish as they come downstream. It's a commonly used technique for these bodies of water. You saw this picture before. This fellow may have the most envied job within BLM and Fish and Wildlife, getting to go out and capture 4-foot-long pike on the river. This was one of the pike that was captured and tagged as part of the telemetry study. These are some things you've heard already. They favor the tributaries with low energy habitats with slower moving water, and the Cusco is poor habitat for pike. This particular fish has obviously thrived in the ecosystem. Most of them aren't that big, but this is caught in one of the tributaries. Going back to some of the data that Angela presented, I just wanted to pull out one particular slide for emphasis. This was the mercury concentration in pike, those particular pike caught in the Kuskokwim River above George, which is the stretch of Red Devil Creek, or the stretch adjacent to Red Devil. So Cusco above George is the downstream stretch directly below the mine. And it has one of the lower mercury concentrations in the pike. Again, small N of 5, because the habitat is just not that good within the river. The habitat in the Holitna, is much better, where you see 109 fish caught, or the Takotna, where you see 31 fish caught. So a small N, not surprising because of the type of habitat, but also a lower mercury level in the pike caught there. The burbot, they're another popular game fish. They're caught a lot during the winter, ice fishing out there in the winter. The Kuskokwim freezes multi-feet thick, and so the locals go out there and catch these much smaller burbot, which swim hundreds of miles up and down the river. So again, they're more likely to be caught in the Kuskokwim than the pike are. And the mercury concentrations in burbot, again, a small N of 4 here, but none of these N's are very large. There is no demonstrable elevation of mercury level from the fish that were caught adjacent and downgradient of the Red Devil site in Burma. So how do we tie this all together in the risk characterization in the few minutes I've got left? This is the fourth step in the process. Just some basic concepts behind risk characterization, where we integrate the toxicity and exposure assessments into qualitative and quantitative expressions of risk. We're still developing the supplemental risk assessment for the remedial investigation, so this report is not going to conclude today with particular qualitative and quantitative expressions of risk. Rather, we're trying to set the stage of how we evaluate a large amount of data and see if the results collectively can lead to an overall conclusion as to whether, as it says in the last red bullet, whether mercury releases from the mine are entering upper trophic level fish and posing a potential risk to villagers. I've gone through this just for thoroughness sake. I've condensed the lines of evidence into four components of risk assessment shown here. I'm going to move on pretty quick. A quick summary. I want to move through these next four slides real quick because we've talked about them, but this just confirms, this is the first step in risk assessment, hazard identification, that mercury from the site is known to be in the sediment in the biota at and near the Kuskokwim River, although in general the habitat is poor for the fish. They're the primary interest for this particular endpoint, subsistence consumption. So poor habitat due to fast river, minimum vegetation, and the other things we've talked about. Toxicity assessment summary, Mercury was not detected in the bottom end of the food chain in the periphyton. The sediment toxicity test showed that the sediments themselves were not toxic or minimal toxicity to sensitive aquatic organisms, and that much of the mercury is sparingly soluble with low bioavailability, but there's a large amount of it in the system from the mine. So three different lines of evidence to include in our understanding of the site characteristics. Exposure assessment summary: subsistence villagers consume pike and burbot, but they're not major components, not like the salmon. They're significant, they're relevant, they're regular, but they're not as substantial as the salmon. Pike are not found in the river very often near Red Devil Mine. They're typically caught in the waterways, and as confirmed by the telemetry and tissue studies, where we caught many more pike in the waterways, the tributaries, than in the Cusco itself. So what does this all mean for our project at Red Devil? You know, really one of the primary issues is understanding the site-specific risk. What risk is being contributed by the mine site? And so we've got to try to distinguish between the regional risk, the background risk, and the site risk. You know, one of our initial conclusions, and I got to be careful here, these are nothing I say from now on is finalized. These are just some observations that BLM is making, but the mercury levels in fish are more representative of regional condition with the burbot that move up and down the waterways, or the home waterways, particularly the tributaries for the pike, rather than representative of the Kuskokwim River directly to the site. So that makes the risks, you know, from these particular endpoints, the fish tissue studies, more regional than truly site-specific. And site-specific risks for this endpoint are hard to quantify because the impact area is small in relation to the home range of the species of interest. The habitat's unattractive. They tend to fish elsewhere. The chemicals of concern, particularly mercury, are widespread in the watershed and the food chain. And one way we're trying to get at the site-specific risk is by doing some sediment to food chain modeling. The supplemental risk assessment in the RI will be doing this modeling exercise to go from the sediment concentrations into the lower and then the upper food chain as part of the uncertainty analysis, so that even though our study shows that there's a large regional component, we're going to do some modeling just to see if we can better understand the particular component that the site may be contributing to the overall regional risk. This just shows the regional mercury concentration in pike in the middle Cusco compared to a number of other areas. Nothing surprising here in that our concentrations are certainly middle of the range or below many of the other regions at the stretch of river near the site. And our risk characterization in the supplemental risk assessment will consider, in addition to the fish consumption I've just discussed, this, just for thoroughness sake, the risk assessment will consider site-specific sediment exposure, multiple lines of evidence for exposure and risk, some of which I've discussed today, the importance of the regional consumption rates and impacts of regional mercury mines on the fish tissue concentrations, and our understanding of local knowledge about fishing practices, where they fish, how they fish. You saw somebody gill netting out there from a boat. There's not thought to be a lot of fishing from shore. Most of the fishing, you know, where they're gill netting or drift netting is done offshore from boats because it's able to collect more fish at once. So we'll use some of this traditional knowledge in our risk assessment evaluation. What's the current project status? We are currently developing this supplemental risk assessment with input from EPA and DEC based on much of the information you've heard here today, the updated collected data, Angela's study that she described, the findings from the risk assessment and the supplemental risk or remedial investigation, sorry, and supplemental remedial investigation, the food consumption rates, and some of the modeling we'll be doing about contaminant uptake. So this is in development right now. with the hopes of being done later this year and available for review. One of the findings I had was that, you know, as I was looking at the literature, I noted that the state has statewide pike and burbot consumption data as well as advisories. And, you know, the total mercury tissue levels in the pike and burbot caught in our reach of river, in the middle Kuskokwim River near Red Devil, are fairly consistent with the median statewide tissue levels of mercury collected between 2001 and 2016. So they're consistent with, you know, I'm not certain as to where all the fish were collected for the statewide study, but this data has been presented, and, you know, there's just obviously no clear distinguishing concentration fingerprint, if you will, or spike for the middle Kuskokwim River tissue concentrations versus that statewide. And the State of Alaska Epidemiology Department has issued fish consumption advisories for mercury across the state, not specific only to the middle Kuskokwim River. This is the specific recommendation for this stretch of river in the vicinity of Red Devil, recommend that the more fish less than 2 feet in length and less of longer fish, you know, if they're smaller and younger or shorter, they tend to have less mercury because the bioaccumulation occurs with time. So there's an advisory in this stretch of river, but there's also advisories that are more restrictive in other river systems across the state. So it's acknowledged to be a widespread problem, the mercury and fish tissue consumption. So next steps, finish the supplemental risk assessment and remedial investigation in conjunction with the state and EPA. Evaluate our collective conclusions, and integrate the findings into the feasibility study for the two portions of the site, the upland portion where the actual activities took place, and the aquatic portions, Red Devil Creek and Kuskokwim River. Part of the plan already known is that BLM intends to remediate Red Devil Creek and the tailings delta in the river that you've been shown. We don't have a feasibility study finalized yet, since we're still finishing up the RI, but these are goals and intended aims of BLM to do those types of remediation. And then finally, we'll develop a proposed plan that will go out for public comment outlining our proposed project goals based on the risk assessment and other aspects of this study. So at this stage, I'd like to turn it back to EPA. First, I'd just like to acknowledge BLM's project manager, Mike McCrum of our Anchorage office. He's the state lead for abandoned mines in Alaska. And I'd like to also do a shout out to the ecology and environment team for all the great work they have done at the site. I'm the one doing the presentation and getting the glory, but Mike and the E&E team were the folks doing the hard work for the RI studies of this particular location. So thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it, the opportunity.
Excellent. Thank you, Doug, and thank you, Angela, for such an informative presentation. We've got a lot of interest from our participants, and I think at this point, I want to try to start reading some of the questions that are coming in from the people who have been listening, and you guys can have a discussion around it and answer some of these questions. So the first question I want to ask you is about, based on your analytical data of the mercury, have you determined the bioaccumulation factor in the fish and how it varies based on the fish species or its age?
Yes, the remedial investigation did look at that, where they measured mercury and methylmercury in different trophic levels, going from obviously the sediment into periphyton, if detectable, or into the benthic invertebrates, into the feeder fish, the forage fish, and the larger fish. So we know that the pike and the burbot have, we know what the site-specific bioaccumulation factors are at the different trophic levels, and we have used that in the remedial investigation already. I don't have those numbers on my hand, but we have done that study.
Okay, great. And I know that your contact information is available with the seminar. Is it okay if the participants wanted to follow up with you if they wanted more specific information on that?
Sure.
Of course. Great. Yeah.
Great. Great.
We'll just refer them to project manager Mike McCrum anyway, so.
That sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, who better be listening?
We have a question about the atmospheric mercury and if the Red Devil mine contributed to atmospheric mercury near the mine, and if you looked at mercury vapor releases, if they were measured in the area.
So this is Angela. Remember that the Red Devil mine itself closed in the late 50s, early 60s. So probably there was a retort facility there. So probably, but that was decades ago. And so currently, no.
Okay. All right. Let's see what question we should go to next here. Angela, there was a question that came in specifically on one of your slides. It was slide 28, and the participant is asking how biological significance was determined or defined.
So biological significance is simply in comparison to literature thresholds for toxicity to fish, and that particular reference is Sandheinrich and Wiener, 2011, methylmercury in freshwater fish, recent advances in assessing toxicity of environmentally relevant exposures. And this is in Environmental Contaminants and Biota, Interpreting Tissue Concentration, second edition from CRC Press. And I can, that reference is actually in the report, in the technical report number 61. So literature thresholds.
Okay, great. Thank you. We got a participant who must have been an attendee at our FRTR meeting because they were saying they were glad to hear this presentation again. And this person is in Maine, and they're finding that mercury levels in northern pike are much lower than in chain pickerel of similar size. And this is in their lakes. But none of which have any point sources, and they're wondering if you have any ideas why they're seeing differences between these closely related fish species.
Sure, yeah, I used to live in Maine and miss it every day. The differences that I can think of would be, number one, age. Even though the pike and pickerel are the same length, they might not be the same age, and that is the when you can determine age, either from scales, but we use primarily otoliths because scales are, there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of variation using scales. So we use, and it has to be obviously lethal sampling to look at the ear bones, the otolith samples. And age would be then, I would imagine that pickerel of the same length as pike would be older than those pike because at least here pike grow to much larger sizes. So that's one thing. The other thing, you know, they are very similar fish and they probably eat, especially when they're the same size, they eat the same things. But another, the primary determinant, all else being equal, if one species of fish has higher mercury concentrations than another and age isn't a factor, would be trophic position, and that can be determined using either diet analysis or stable isotopes of nitrogen and carbon. But the first thing I'd go for is the age and do it by measuring otolith age, ear bones.
Okay, great. Thank you. So Doug, we got a question about you had showed a stabilized area of mine tailings at the Red Devil mine site. Can you share any thoughts on how long it'll take to show any improvement in the mercury levels in the macroinvertebrates, the sculpins, and the fish in the Red Devil Creek?
You know, they've already done some interim actions where they've pulled tailings out of the creek. They've stabilized the shorelines. They put in gabion barriers with big rocks to stabilize the whole structure. I don't know how recently they've collected data post-remedy, but I think that within the last couple of years, they've shown significant improvement in the lower stretches of Red Devil Creek from that collected lake in 2009. So in the last, you know, they did these interim actions in the early 11, 12, 13 range and have collected some follow-up data that's showing improvement. I don't, you know, we have to get to the final action before we can really draw any long-term conclusions about the cessation of input to the creek. But it's underway. It's underway.
Okay. Great. We had a number of questions about the salmon and the fact that it's a significant contributor to the local diets, and questions about were there any efforts to characterize the mercury concentration in the salmon?
So I can address that, and in fact, we, the Fish and Wildlife Service and the state of Alaska, have characterized mercury in salmon tissues, in king salmon and chum salmon, which are the wild Alaska salmon that spawn in the Kuskokwim, and their muscle concentrations are a tenth or an order of magnitude lower than what we see in the resident freshwater fish in the pike and burbot. But probably so they're relatively low, but the bigger issue for this work is that when, you know, when people eat those, they're coming in from the ocean. They've spent 2 years for a small jack salmon, up to 6 or 7 or even 8 years for a large king salmon in the ocean. And so their exposure regime would have been in the ocean rather than receiving anything from the freshwater system. Once they start moving up the rivers to spawn, they're not eating at all. They're focused on spawning. So we do have those data. The concentrations are very low, an order of magnitude lower than in the pike and the burbot. But more importantly, their exposure scenario would not be in the freshwater system.
Okay. And I guess on that same notion, have you done any work with looking at the exposure to the humans that are, you know, using the area for recreation and their consumption?
So it's a remote area. Recreation is probably, there are people who go in there for trophy fishing, for trophy pike, and as you saw by that huge, the two pictures of that huge monster, but it's expensive, and so the it's not a common route of exposure. However, the state of Alaska does have a hair biomonitoring mercury program for women of childbearing age and children, and it's free. Anyone who is concerned about their mercury exposure, and the state has actually done some targeted sampling in some of the villages on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, where the higher mercury concentrations in pike tend to be. So there is monitoring of people who eat a subsistence amount of fish, of these freshwater fish. And I just looked up those data, and at least from 2012, it's the latest report I see, the hair mercury concentrations, most of them were below 2 parts per million, and I think 5 parts per million in hair is the World Health Organization level of concern. It looks like, so most were below 2, it looks like the most of those were actually below 1 part per million. So at least based on hair monitoring, there seems to be relatively low mercury exposure in people in the region who, and most of these people are living a subsistence way of life. The what's not evaluated, of course, are the mercury-selenium interactions in the fish and in people. This is but it does show relatively low levels of mercury exposure.
Okay.
Given the caveats associated with that right. Gross measure.
Okay, thank you. We have a participant who wanted to know if there was any historical trend charts showing the mercury concentrations and how they've changed over the years in the rivers or the fish and in the people.
I would say no. The Alaska is so big that there have been a variety of studies done on a variety of fish and in a variety of locations. But consistent data over time is hard to get. Probably the and so in the freshwater fish, there might be some specific locations where that has occurred, but it's not put together for this region. And the reason why I'm hesitating is because I'm trying to sift in my mind through all the sources of data. Certainly for other biota, there are.
I would add that the sediment, the routine sediment monitoring in the Kuskokwim River really only goes back to about 2010, you know, as part of the remedial investigation. Otherwise, things were just very sporadic and spotty with no kind of consistent program at all and no even data collection much before that. So we don't have that information that the questioner asked about. That's just not available.
Yeah, it's a very remote area.
Okay, thank you. We have a number of people who are actually wondering how long the radio implant lasts in the fish.
Well, the radio implant itself lasts until they die. The battery life of those for the bigger fish, the pike and the burbot, if they're big enough to get a radio, that battery life, they lasted around 2, maybe we got 3 years out of them. Most of them were cut off right at 2 years. The smaller Arctic grayling, which I didn't discuss the results from those, but there were some Arctic grayling who also received radios. Those were smaller fish, smaller implants, smaller batteries, and so they lasted about a year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have someone who was participating that they're talking about in their experience that they've worked in treating mercury at an acidic mining influence water at a gold mine, and they had some questions about if you knew of any studies that looked at biochemical reactors' effluence for increases or decreases in the sulfur methylation.
You know, I saw that question, and I was trying to rack my brains specifically, specifically I don't have an answer for that. I did recently see a recent newsletter or publication that might have addressed that, but I can't remember specifically. So if we have access to these questions, I can follow up on that for the participants.
Yes, yes, okay? Definitely. We have a transcript of the questions that we can share.
Great. Okay.
You raised an interesting point that I don't think I hit on discussing the site. This site is interesting in that we don't have acid mine drainage as a particular issue. It's not a very sulfate-rich site, and so although we have lots of arsenic and antimony and mercury, we don't have an acid mine or acid rock drainage issue here of any particular concern. So that's different from a lot of sites like gold sites in particular.
Okay. We have another question about the human and ecological health, and there's any implications, excuse me, of mercury-selenium interactions.
I don't think selenium was found to be particularly elevated or much of a problem. I'd have to go back and look at what the risk assessment as part of the RI did. I don't have a feel for how much of a – I don't think that was much of a problem. Everything was studied pretty thoroughly, but I don't have a specific answer for you at this time.
Okay. We have a question about what mercury bioaccumulation factor you plan to use in any modeling analysis and how you will deal with any of its uncertainties.
We'll use site-specific bioaccumulation factors from the different food chains where we have them as best we understand them. Otherwise, we'll pick, you know, conservative literature values that we can agree upon with the EPA and the DEC. And, you know, I guess it's possible we would use, you know, several different values to sort of bound the uncertainty associated with doing a modeling exercise. So that's underway right now with our contractor, Ecology and Environment, but I don't have a specific reference or something I can give you for what values we're using.
Okay, thanks. I think we have time for one more question. So this person was referencing that in one of your slides you said that 80 to 90% of total mercury was methylated, and they're just curious if this is something that's being replicated in other cases throughout the U.S. or the world, or is this dependent on the local geology?
So in fish tissue, in fish muscle tissue in particular, the majority of total mercury is methylated mercury because it's bound to the proteins in muscle, and that's what you're measuring. It's going to be different for different organs, but in muscle, you can assume that the majority, and in my data, it ranges from 75 to 99% of total mercury is methylated, and that's true really worldwide. Once it gets into the tissue, it does in the methylated form.
Okay, well, thank you again. Like I said, we generated a lot of discussion here. Your presentation appears to have been very interesting to our participants. We have a number of questions that we weren't able to get to, but we will pass along the transcript to Doug and Angela and talk about how we can reach out to the folks to answer their questions that we didn't get to today. But again, thank you, Doug, and thank you, Angela, for an excellent presentation. We really appreciate your participation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you. So now I'm going to turn the session over to Roslyn Ramsey, who's going to talk to you about our upcoming CLUIN.org mining webinars and the two more that we're doing as part of this FRTR Presents.
Thank you, Michelle, and thank you, Doug and Angela, for your time and participation today. I just have another reminder for the next webinars in this series that we have. Again, it's called FRTR Presents Heavy Metals Mining Site Characterization and Treatment. We have session 2 on July 26, 2017, where Barbara Butler, an environmental engineer for the EPA, and Charles Cravata, a research hydrologist with USGS, will explain potential applications of anaerobic water treatment techniques for remediation of mining-influenced water and aqueous geochemical modeling. And then the third session of this series will be on August 10th, 2017, and we will have Matthew Bobo from BLM and Kate Campbell from USGS, who will focus on different techniques that can be implemented for site characterization and modeling. Matthew will discuss the use of unmanned aircraft for biological surveys at sites, while Kate will discuss best practices for monitoring and modeling in situ biogeochemical processes for uranium treatments and AMD. And that's all I have, and I'll pass it off to Jean to close out for the rest of today.
Thank you so very much, Rosalyn. Let me walk everybody through just a few final reminders before we close things out today. We did have over 330 individuals join us from all over the world for today's live broadcast. I'll cover just a couple of the most popular questions that we get. First of all, a number of you asked for copies of the presentation materials. I just wanted to remind you all that you can find that on the seminar resources or links page, which is available on the middle right under related URLs. If you scroll through and click the seminar resources link and then press the Browse To button, that page will open, and we do have all three presentations loaded up there. We also have a copy of Technical Report Number 61 from the BLM that's been posted as a related link, so you guys can also access that file right from the related URLs window. One of the biggest questions we get are people looking for copies of their training records or participation certificates, so I just wanted to remind everyone that you can visit the following website on CLUIN and actually enter in your email address, and we will automatically send you an email that contains a table of all of the webinars that you've joined, and if you notice any discrepancies, you can reply to us and let us know. We can correct that As I highlighted earlier, the presentation materials and the reports have been posted under related URLs to the seminar resources page, so you can download those at any time. If you're watching the recorded version, guess what? You can still click on those links and access those files as well by clicking on the link of interest and pressing the Browse to button. If you could also take just a brief moment and fill out the online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's seminar, including not only the content that we covered, but the way that we hosted it, we would greatly appreciate it. We do read each and every one of those submissions, so I can assure you that your comments will be looked at and very much appreciated. Also, when you fill out that online feedback form, there's a box you can check, and as long as you check it, confirming you were there for the entire session, we will send you a participation certificate by email. You can also print it or save it for your own records. So for those of you who are looking for that type of documentation, be sure to fill out the online feedback form to get one of those certificates. If you participated as a group, each person can fill out that form and get their own certificate, even though you attended under one registration spot. And again, that still applies for those of you replaying the recorded version. You can still share your feedback based off of your replay of the archive. So I want to thank the, again, over 330 individuals who joined us, as well as our presenters who took time out of their busy schedules to join us for today's broadcast. As noted, today's session was recorded, and you will automatically receive an email as soon as the archive is available. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks. So I hope